The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, the Champions League. Spurs beat Real Madrid in bizarrely straightforward fashion. Could Zinedine Zidane be the next manager to go just after we've finished recording the pod? Sergio Aguero's Manchester City's record scorer after a 4-2 win in Naples. And there are easy wins for Liverpool and Manchester United. Chelsea get stuffed in Rome. They're this week's club in crisis. Permanently in crisis, Sunderland need a new manager. I've sent Baz's CV in. Also today, we'll chat to the brilliant Guardian cartoonist David Squires. Look ahead to this weekend. Add your questions, feedback corner, and you get Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel. Barry Glendenning, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Although I have broken wings by Mr. Mister playing on a loop in my head and it won't stop.
Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
But I just spent all morning going dum dum ba dum 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 the bass line.
Do you want to carry on with it?
No.
Okay. Are you ruling yourself out of the Sunderland job?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Anyone crazy enough to want that job is too crazy to do it.
Archie Rintutt, how are you?
Very well.
Is it your dad's birthday again? What brings you over?
No, I was here for Manchester United against Benfica.
How was your dad's birthday?
It was good. I presented him with a shirt with his name on the back. He looked delighted. Yeah. So it was all good.
You didn't tell him that I feel he's now too old to wear a replica shirt?
I didn't. I feel that would kind of ruin the facade for him.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
No.
Sorry, Mr. Rintutt. Andy Brussel, how are you?
I'm very good. Yeah. And if Archie successfully presented the shirt to his dad, well, maybe he could be a candidate for the Sunderland job. Because that is a big part of the job, isn't it? Handing over a shirt and doing a handshake.
Did you do a handshake? Yeah, when you handed it over, was it a handshake?
I'll show you.
You actually got it officially.
Yeah.
No, that's an absolute tragedy, isn't it?
It is.
How old's your dad?
60.
60, okay.
60.
And he manfully posed for such a photo without feeling... Oh, no, he really did. Oh, that is marvellous, isn't it? With 60, Rindo.
Yes, on the back.
Is that what you call him? Or do you call him Dad?
I don't call him that. His mates call him that.
Oh, that's really...
I just call him Dad.
Okay, well, that's a lovely insight.
I know, right?
Into the Rintutt household. Okay, then. Well, let's begin at Wembley. Tottenham 3, Real Madrid 1. Real Madrid's first defeat in 30 Champions League group games. First team to beat them in the group stages since 2012, Spurs. But I couldn't help wondering if this was Spurs being brilliant or Real Madrid being bad.
I was wondering who was going to be the first grinchy person to make that point.
And it's a really sad time when I'm grinchier before you are, Baz.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's get it out of the way. Real Madrid are not going through a good spell. They were missing some key players, but they are still the European champions and they are still Real Madrid and... It was still a fantastic performance by Spurs. I think it would be churlish in the extreme to put their success down to Real Madrid's current lack of form.
And they made Real Madrid look bad, didn't they?
Yeah, and I'm absolutely amazed how far Tottenham have come in the Champions League in the space of just 1 year. I mean, I think this time last year, I was watching the second of their three Wembley games in the Champions League against Bayer Leverkusen. They were dreadful. I mean, they were made to look very ordinary by Bayer Leverkusen. The atmosphere was totally flat. They could barely string three passes together. And to go from looking so green... And not having a Europa League run, because, of course, they went out the first time of asking in the Europa League, to reach this point where they've played like a really experienced European team from the very first game against Dortmund, where, you know, they had to defend in the first half and did it very well, and then pick them off in the second half, and they picked Real Madrid off very effectively, especially in the second half last night. I think is unbelievable. And, of course, well done the players, but you have to give an enormous amount of credit to Pochettino.
You do, because if you think about it, after Alderweireld went off, who was there? Their holding midfield was Winks and Sissoko, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that's against...
Winks was outstanding. Winks was unbelievable last night. Just, I mean, he didn't get the assist for the first or the third goal, but his passes in behind, firstly, for Trippier. Okay, it was offside, but that's kind of been swept under the carpet a little bit. And then the pass to start the move for the counter-attack for the third goal as well. was outstanding. And I think he's going to make the England squad ahead of Jack Wilshere, and I would say deservedly so on his performances against Real Madrid. But the thing about Spurs, I think, last night as well, was that it seemed like they still had energy to give. It seemed like they still weren't in top gear and they were beating Real Madrid. I think that was part of the amazing thing. They were excellent in terms of the way they took their chances, but I still thought that Spurs weren't exactly having to be right at the very top of their game.
But hasn't that sort of been a thing, I suppose, for English clubs in Europe about energy conservation, about game management? I think that's what sets them apart, really, this season, and that's what I think marks how far they've come, that they've managed to figure that out.
I think they're almost suited as well to perhaps playing against these slightly bigger opponents in terms of Real Madrid and Dortmund as opposed to last year. That's what it's taken to get the very best out of them, yeah, in really a way. And actually, Dele Alli was saying last night that after the game against Real Madrid in the first leg, he was a little bit surprised in terms of how much space. The balls looked almost too easy to play. And you saw them last night actually take that ruthless touch, because once again, all the space was there. And it was amazing to see just how poor and sloppy the likes of Kroos and Modric in the centre of that Real Madrid midfield, who have been easily the best midfield trio in the last year or so, just how bad they were.
Is that a thing, Andy, to going about managing a game in Champions League differently to how you would manage any other game?
Well, I think when I know we can kind of overcook sometimes the uniqueness of the Premier League and its pace and its physical demands, but I do think there has to be a switch in how you deal with a game. I do feel English clubs have really gone hell for leather a bit too much. I suppose we'll get onto it, but Napoli and Manchester City. That Napoli did exactly against Manchester City what they'd done against Real Madrid last year. And of course, Napoli had a little bit of bad luck last night, especially with the change out to make a fullback after half an hour. But, you know, they really went for Manchester City from the start and they couldn't maintain it. And that, I think, you know, we've heard Pep Guardiola talk so much about Maurizio Sarri and what a great coach he is and all the rest of it. But he doesn't really seem to have learnt that much in this year. Yeah, Napoli are still very attractive. They played a very good game against Manchester City. They gave a very good account of themselves for a lot of it. But the change in Tottenham is remarkable, I think.
Can we praise the delivery of Kieran Trippier, which is something that he's been consistently good at even before he was at Spurs. But technically, that cross is not easy to do, to play at the right pace in exactly the corridor of uncertainty on a plate, really, for Dele Alli. And he's done it a few times.
Yeah, but I don't think it's something he's learned at Spurs particularly. I mean, I remember the first season Burnley came up to the Premier League. He had, I think, 18 assists in the Championship that season, you know, all crosses. You know, so his delivery has always been one of his strong points. And he's just excellent, yeah. I mean, Kyle Walker is not missed there at all, I don't think.
Who would you pick if you were Southgate?
I'd probably pick Kyle Walker because I've met him and he's very nice.
Oh, good. you really should be the Sunderland manager, I think. And also, it was a big day for Dele Alli because a lot's been made of how brilliant he was last year and how he hasn't necessarily started this season like that. And I just thought, like, the balance, I know it was a deflected finish and there was luck with the first goal, was offside, and there was the luck with the deflection, but the balance and the poise to just, did he sit Casemiro down? He basically just leant one way and the Real Madrid defence fell over.
I think it was Nacho.
Was it Nacho?
Nacho, he sat down and then he took that fantastic deflection off Sergio Ramos as well. Sergio Ramos, who received a mighty kick as well from Moussa Dembele at the end.
Oh, yeah.
You could almost hear Moussa Dembele in his head going, this one is for every other defender in Europe.
Zafar says, is Zidane any good or is he just a higher profile Avram Grant?
Wow. I mean, you know, he's under no illusions how it is at Real Madrid. He knows that every defeat is pretty much a crisis. And I think that's what's enabled him to deal with the pressure, to compartmentalise and to be so successful there. They're in a spot at the moment. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I thought it was interesting, Cristiano Ronaldo pointing out after the game how much experience they've lost. I mean, we talk about their deep squad. We talk about how strong they were in retaining the Champions League and how they sort of followed the Asensio route in reinforcing with really good younger players. So you can see the short and medium and long term in their squad. On the other hand, as Ronaldo was pointing out, they've lost Pep, they've lost James, and that does have implications in terms of depth and experience. You know, the players who've got to come in are younger. And of course, Zidane will give younger players their chance, but you know, it's difficult when you can't bring in them, or you can't bring in Morata, for example. So I think we're starting to see a sort of callow side to Real Madrid at the moment. I think I have a problem with people getting stuck into Zidane, actually, because I think it's not just about the stuff that he's won, but I think he's been a very decisive coach. But he's a coach who the media find very hard to get a handle on, I think, because he doesn't surround himself with myth like a lot of coaches are very, very fond of doing. You know, he makes stuff so simple. He doesn't wrap it up in smoke and mirrors in press conferences. And I think people look at him, and a lot of journalists look at him and think, well, you know, if he can't express himself in really his philosophy in really clear terms, maybe there's nothing going on in his head, and maybe it's just the players, which I think is a very, very harsh reading of it.
Who would you say is the manager who is most covered in myth?
Who most covers himself in myth? Well, it's Jose Mourinho, isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, I thought so.
Comfortably.
Zidane has been in charge of Real now for more than 100 games. I don't think, no matter how good your players are, you can't spoof your way through 100 games without, at some point, you know, getting found out.
And this it's possible Zafar really rates Avram Grant, though, isn't it? You
know? Yeah.
Unfortunately, we only too rarely see what Zidane looks like in a tracksuit.
That's true. Cy Ram says, after their win against Real and Dortmund, is it inevitable that Spurs players will be picked apart next summer like Monaco this year?
Don't think so. They all seem to be buying into the Pochettino philosophy. You know, Harry Kane could easily triple his wages elsewhere, but has shown no indication whatsoever that he has any interest in doing so. And I think players who don't buy into the Pochettino myth get, you know, railroaded out very quickly. And they all seem quite happy with their lot and content to see where Pochettino will take them.
I think the difference between Spurs and Monaco is, actually, I think Spurs will make a deep run into this competition this season. You can, okay, you mentioned the stat at the start there, Max, that the last time that anyone beat Real Madrid in the group stages was 5 years ago. That was the Borussia Dortmund team that ended up going on to reach the Champions League final even. I think that's a little bit too far to say in terms of the hype, those expectations, but I certainly think that Spurs can go deep into the tournament. And I think the difference is that Spurs is probably a little bit more of a pull than Monaco in terms of staying at and what they're actually building there. So I can see maybe one or two leaving, but I think that actually Spurs are here to stay.
There was maybe a feeling that Monaco kind of reached a limit, wasn't there, at the end of last season for more of those players than the club anticipated, because they only really anticipated selling two or three. But I think the pressure from within the club and the amounts of money that were being offered from those players, particularly from Premier League clubs, were just too much to resist. I do think money comes into it with Spurs, though. Of course, ambition is a big deal, and the feeling that they're going somewhere. Of course, holding on to Pochettino is absolutely key, as Barry was saying. But the gulf in wages between what they get at Spurs and the very top players in the Premier League or at Real Madrid or Barcelona is going to become an issue sooner or later.
But how is it not already? Because Spurs haven't won anything. Because already, you know,
because there's that feeling of momentum, I think, and because Pochettino is driven that so much, because the stadium's in the pipeline. But you know, you have to hit very, very high sporting high points to sweep that under the carpet for too much longer. And I have to say, the way they've started the season the last few seasons, has just been the way that Daniel Levy's dealt with the transfer market. And that's not going to fly for much longer, just as him underpaying the players is not going to fly for much longer. How much they're constrained by the new stadium, I don't know. But something has to give, I think, at some point.
Sorry. I think we should also give a tip of the hat to our old friend Jimbo. Did you hear his line last night?
Yes.
Real Madrid were like salami sliced up on the counter by the deli man.
As I replied,
why don't you come out with lines
as
like
I,
that?
As I replied in a tweet to me saying, yeah, what would Max have done? I'd have said, Dele Alli kicked it and it went in. And Jimbo liked that tweet. So there we are. Spurs are through. Real Madrid are basically there because Dortmund can only draw at home to Apoel Nicosia. Is that, Archie, the surprise, isn't it?
it is and it isn't because of the way they've been playing in the last few weeks. If you look at their last eight or so performances, you would say that only one good one has been there, and that was against third-tier Magdeburg in the DFB Cup. So the way that things are going at the moment, there's a lot of criticism for Peter Bosz's system at Dortmund and the amount of space that is being left in behind there. He says that he said at the weekend, for example, against Hannover, he was up so late that night that he was able to put the clocks back himself. He was thinking about the game.
I always feel sorry for whoever's doing the overnight show at a radio station when they've just done 1 a.m. to 2 a.m. and they go, it's 1 a.m. It's a pressing time.
He could have done that himself. But I think that performances have dropped off and the goals have as well. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is still the Bundesliga top scorer this season, but has not scored in his last four games in all competitions. But I think that defensively, whether they have the right tools to play the system that they're doing at the moment is questionable. Everything was working in the first few weeks of the season, but going into this game against Bayern Munich now on the weekend, you would say that the momentum is very much with Bayern right now, because Dortmund, just particularly in the centre of the park, Julian Weigl is such a key player for that side at the base and that midfield. He's come back from a long-term injury at the beginning of this season, and he's not hit the ground running exactly. So, yeah, it's not looking good for Dortmund right now. And a few people I know were saying they can see them dropping points against Apoel. And you think if they'd taken 6 points against Apoel, they would be right in the group now, because they'd just be a point off Real Madrid, for example. But instead, they're looking at a spring without European football, potentially, if Apoel can take a point.
You mentioned Manchester City, Andy. Let's move on to that. 4-2 at Napoli. Aguero finally got his record, surpassing Eric Brooks' highest scoring player in Manchester City's history, 178 goals in 264 appearances. We all obviously think Sergio Aguero is a brilliant footballer, but I wonder if he isn't quite regarded as well as he should be. Do you know what I mean? I just don't feel there's not this kind of, you know, we're talking about myths. There's not a myth of Aguero, despite that record, which is brilliant.
He's really in the mix, for Ballon d'Or, and I know that's not a big deal. Well, it's not a big deal to me, because I think it's kind of an anachronism in a team sport. But yeah, I think people have underrated what an incredible Premier League player he's been, and he's been the best player in the Premier League. Maybe not now, but for a few years, I think it's fair to say.
Why is that? Because it's not that he's not exciting, is it? I mean,
it's not. And the fact that Manchester City have relied so heavily on him for so many years, I feel that the arrival of Gabriel Jesus, rather than finishing him off like a lot of people thought it would, has almost given him a little bit more liberty. The fact that there's not that humongous pressure on him now. Every time you watch Manchester City play in the last 4 or 5 years, every time Aguero goes down, every time he holds anywhere approaching the back of his leg, everyone's got their heart in their mouth. Not anymore, I don't think. And that gives him a bit of freedom. I think Guardiola has demanded a little bit more of him as well, because when he arrived at Manchester City, he was very much the complete striker. He was someone who didn't just score the goals, but who dropped deep 40 yards from goal, who ran the channels, who made passes and stuff like that as well. And I think because Manchester City was so reliant on him not getting injured, I think it's quite likely that he's received the advice at some point, don't do all that stuff, because we don't want you to get injured. We need you to be in the team and score goals for us. Now, because it's not the end of the world if he misses a couple of games, I feel he's almost off the leash, because, of course, he's still under 30, to go and do all that other stuff that made him such an incredible footballer in the first place.
You mentioned the game as well. I mean, I don't know. Well, actually, on that Aguero thing, I do think if you're going to get the record, should your celebration be the Hulk Hogan ears? You know, I mean, he didn't do the sort of roundy bit and then that, but still.
Do you remember Alan Shearer's celebration when he scored twice at Blackburn? Was it to go over 200 Premier League goals? And I remember on FIFA 99, you know, all the players did ridiculous celebrations, even if they didn't do ridiculous celebrations in real life. And Alan Shearer used to go to the corner flag and play air guitar, which is totally bizarre. But Alan Shearer did a kind of Usain Bolt type thing before Bolt was around for those two goals at Blackburn. And I think that's been swept under the historical
carpet.
That's
strange, because
it was horrible.
Because obviously we only know one Alan Shearer celebration.
Exactly.
Who had sex with the corner flag? Was it on Tuesday night?
Leyvin Kazawa.
I mean, what was that?
I think
that?
It was more a slow dance, Max. Come on.
Yes, you're right. Actually, I've over-exaggerated there and given people an insight into my world. On Manchester City, every pundit says, well, everyone has a blip. You know, at some point in the season, Brian, you know, they're going to have a tough time. But I just can't see...
I think maybe they had it against West Brom last weekend and still won 3-2.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't see where it's going to happen. Obviously, their defence is not as good as their attack, but still.
But haven't you felt in like the first game against Manchester City, and as you were saying, Barry, against West Brom, that you know those are both games that they should have won by a cricket score, really. And they almost managed to find a way not to win it. I don't think anyone's doubting that they're going to continue playing fantastic football, scoring goals and winning games. But they haven't been clinical in recent weeks. I think that's maybe something to think about.
Look,
you've got to keep the narrative going. Come
yeah,
on.
No, I understand.
It is only November.
Yeah.
But we have seen challenges fall away. I would still be, if we're still saying this in February, fine, but I think we're still very
okay.
early to
okay,
say
okay, I haven't given them the title yet and the Champions League. Shakhtar beat final 3-1. So City are through. Shakhtar need 1 point from their last two games. Roma-Chelsea then. Tony Cascarino, I was on the radio with him yesterday. He was saying Chelsea are in crisis. Barry, do you think they're in crisis?
They were certainly in crisis on Tuesday. The talk is that Antonio Conte has fallen out with at least one sort of senior member of the Chelsea hierarchy. Roman Abramovich, he's not happy with the recruitment policy during the summer, and Roman Abramovich tends not to be very patient when his team is playing badly, and they were shocking on Tuesday. I mean, there was some calamitous defending. I think we all saw it didn't actually lead to a goal, but the ball was hoofed long to Edin Dzeko. He was holding it up on the right side of the pitch in the sort of in the channel, and all three Chelsea centre defenders ran across. He's
quite under 11s,
yeah,
isn't it?
It was like something you would see in a schoolyard, everyone chasing the ball. Dzeko squared it to a completely unmarked Perotta, and he somehow managed to shank it over the bar. But it was just incredibly bad defending. And, you know, Chelsea were a goal down within a minute, despite, or within 40 seconds.
But what a goal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that you know, sometimes we forget to analyse just someone kicking a ball beautifully, and El Shaarawy was just... I don't know if you can hit a ball cleaner than that.
Well, I mean, that was his second worldie in as many games, because he had one at the weekend as well when Roma beat Bologna, just an unbelievable volley from a corner, I think it was. But, Chelsea were astonishingly poor.
Andy, is this just because Kante's not there? With Kante, played 9-1-6, lost 2-4 clean sheets. Without, played 6-1-3, lost 2-1 clean sheet.
It's a big part of it. I feel they haven't got that stability, not just tactically this season, but you know the fact that in terms of transfer business, it's always going to come back to that, isn't it? And the fact that I think the recruitment's nice. It's just not far enough, really. You know, you don't really sense that depth. And on the other hand, Roma are the other side of the coin, because they lost Mo Salah, which has really affected the way they play. And I've not been convinced by them in the early weeks of the season. But Monchi, who's a very diligent team and squad builder, of course, he'd always said, well, look, our squad's going to be deeper. And this is the week where it really proved it, because you talked about that game at Bologna at the weekend. They won it with that wonder goal, but they weren't brilliant at all, because they left out De Rossi, they left out Nainggolan, and then you've got the situation where they played Chelsea with those two having had a rest at the weekend. It made an enormous difference, I think.
Just to add on terms of the recruitment, I think actually who they let go in terms of when you're talking about the Kante position as such, with Nemanja Matic being allowed to leave to Manchester United, you can't see any other big club who would sell such a vital player to a rival in that way to strengthen them. I still find that a very bizarre move. But with Kante, I think it was almost inevitable at some point an injury was going to occur, given the fact that in the last two seasons, whether it's for Leicester, he plays constantly week in, every week. For Chelsea, the same, but with no European football. That challenge of them playing three games a week, I think, given the amount that he puts himself about, I think that was always going to catch up with him perhaps at some point. And I think that Bakayoko on his own, I think, is struggling a little bit to adapt.
They lost 3-0. They could have lost by a hell of a lot more as well. Thibaut Courtois played very well. Roma squandered some great chances, no one more so than Perotti. But just the sloppiness in possession of Chelsea as well. You know, Cesc Fabregas giving away the ball carelessly on numerous occasions. One point it led to a goal. And yeah, it was just weird to see them being... You know, I would not have liked to have been a Chelsea player going into that dressing room at the end of the game to face Conte, but you know, he has to share a fair amount of the blame.
Yeah, Chelsea is still in a good position to qualify, though, because Atletico failed to beat Karabakh for a second time. I was expecting them to win that one, Andy.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to what Archie was saying about Dortmund, really. It kind of is a surprise and it isn't. I mean, they were talking in Marca today about it being the most profound crisis in the whole time that Diego, 6+ years that Diego Simeone's been at Atletico Madrid. They've looked very stale at the start of this season. I think Gabby, the captain, sort of hit the nail on the head when he was talking rather bluntly after the Karabag game. He was saying it's all very well talking about the fact that we're going to get Diego Costa in January. Well, if we play like we're playing at the moment, it won't make any difference because we'll be so far off our objectives. We won't be able to get to them.
Is there anything being said about the new stadium? Atleti, is that having
like
any
a hoodoo?
Yeah.
It is a big deal, actually, because Diego Simeone, who's always been very big on the Calderon being part of them and part of the way they play, and you know, we're the working class heroes who come from the barrio and this is what we're about. He took them back to train at the Calderon before the Karabakh game to sort of get some of that old feeling. And the fact is, it didn't make any difference. They were still flat as a pancake.
Manchester United beat Benfica 2-0. Here's a tweet from Daniel who says, "I don't believe in evil, but Jose's the closest I've seen in football. Does he run on misery and chaos, or is he just an arse?" Archie, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
I did.
Oh, that's good.
And actually, the game was quite enjoyable for the first half an hour or so. It then got a little bit scrappier, you would say. But I thought that actually, particularly the way that Anthony Martial was running at the Benfica right-hand side was causing all sorts of problems. He was a delight to watch. But apart from that, in terms of the first half and what Manchester United were offering, it wasn't all that much. It did kind of seem like there was just attacking freedom being given to the Manchester United's forward line, and then there didn't seem to be all that much of a plan in terms of how to break down Benfica. I thought that Miles Vilar, the teenage goalkeeper who became the youngest goalkeeper to start in the Champions League the other week, and then became the youngest Champions League goalkeeper, I think, to save a penalty this week from Anthony Martial.
Must be the youngest one to catch a ball exactly. And take into his own net, and the youngest one to have one bounce in off his head as well.
He's setting all kinds of records.
He's the youngest to score an own goal in the Champions League, isn't he, as well?
Yeah.
I mean, that is quite an introduction to first team football, isn't it?
It was very unfortunate, you'd have to say, because it just hits the post and ricochets off his back. But I think that he was certainly a bright spot for Benfica, and he's one to watch. But I thought United on the whole, it wasn't the sort of performance which is going to exactly dispel those claims of Jose Mourinho there being evil. But I'd say evil's a little bit harsh. But I think very encouraging performance from Scott McTominay on his Champions League debut as well. And he looked very assured in the centre of United's midfield. But I think they do miss Paul Pogba. I have no idea when he's coming back. But I think that they could really do with him to perhaps give them a little bit more attacking flair.
Do you think Manchester United fans care? I mean, I just wonder if this is just so much of people like us talking about Manchester United not being exciting. And I know some of the fans were giving a bit of stick, but I wonder if most of them just want to win and will take it for now.
It doesn't help that Jose Mourinho seems to be waging war on the fans. Mm. That there was a very clear chant in the first half when they were singing Jose Mourinho's name, and Jose Mourinho was standing out on the touchline just looking at the game. I think he almost just threw one glance in their direction, then just looked back. You would normally expect him to kind of just raise the hand and salute them, but he wrote in his programme notes that some of you obviously didn't seem to enjoy the game against Spurs. It was quite pointed.
The Supporters Trust have asked for a meeting with Jose to discuss his concerns about the atmosphere at Old Trafford.
Well, I mean, the Manchester United fans were soundly outsung by their Benfica counterparts during that game.
They were fantastic. They were fantastic right to the very end. It was a very stoic performance. Even kind of 90 minutes gone, they've picked up no points in the Champions League so far this season, but they were by far the loudest throughout the night.
Manchester United's away support, you know, incredible. But yeah, at home, you know, you've day trippers and tourists, and they're sitting there with their big megastore bags full of tat, and it's not conducive to a good atmosphere. And Old Trafford is far from the only ground that suffers from that.
What do we think about the penalty incident? Blint took it, Lukaku wanted it.
Surprised that Romelu Lukaku is not kind of wrestling the ball off his teammates in those scenarios when he needs a goal, and Jose Mourinho has described him as untouchable from criticism. I'm surprised that Mourinho doesn't tell him to go get the ball. I know he missed a penalty against Kasper Schmeichel the other week, but I think ultimately Mourinho's proved right because Blind scores in that situation, but I don't think you can make too much out of it. Just, I would say, surprised that Lukaku is not going to snatch the ball.
Well, Manchester United are basically through. They've got 12. They're not totally through, but they basically are. The other game in this group, Basel 1, Cesca 2. They're both on 6 points. And as we've already established, Benfica have 0 points. That will do for part one. We'll be back with part two and we'll begin at Anfield. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Liverpool 3, Maribor 0. Roy Keane has said some fun things. If Liverpool played in my back garden, I wouldn't watch them, which is funny and can't be true if you took it literally, because obviously you'd just be totally bemused as to why they were there in your garden playing, and you would definitely watch them for many reasons. Andy, did you like what Roy had to say?
I think that's really harsh. I mean, what were they meant to do against Maribor, against a team that they're beaten 7-0 in the away game? All they had to do was win it. I have to say, I think criticism of Liverpool from a stylistic sense, especially with the entertainment that they provide, generally is bizarre.
I would certainly be opening my curtains and watching Liverpool in my back garden, such as the amount of entertainment they're providing. I think a few other clubs' fans would be doing the same as well, given the way that Dejan Lovren has defended so charitably in the past few weeks. But I don't think he needs any more criticism. But I think that it was only natural that after the fact, I mean, Jurgen Klopp pointed it out himself in his post-match interview, that after the way that Maribor got torn apart by Liverpool in their own backyards by 7, that's probably the wrong time to use that cliche after Roy Keane's quote, but after they lost so spectacularly 7-0, they were always going to try to go to Anfield and prove a point that we're not that easy to blow over in that sense. And I think that they did that in the first half. It was always going to be a matter of time until they were taken apart. But I think that also the expectations of the Anfield crowd in that first half was merely that, okay, are we gonna hit another kind of cricket score here? So
what would it have proved, even if they'd have beaten them like 7-0 again?
That Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain can gain a little more confidence perhaps in the next few weeks.
Yeah, that maybe. Roy Keane would watch them if they were in his garden. I wonder how big...
If Roy Keane sort of heard a Field of Dreams type, if you build it, they will come voice in his head, mm-hmm. and went to his garden and, well, his wheat field, which I presume he has, mm-hmm. and turned it into a football pitch, mm-hmm. with bleachers and whatever, who would he want to turn up? The ghosts of which team, do you think?
I reckon 2002 Ireland. That would be my guess. Versus
Nottingham Forest. Yeah. Cove Ramblers, yeah. Where he started.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know, I'd just like to know how big Roy Keane's garden is. Emre Can's goal was lovely. Liam Becker sent a tweet saying, Emre Can has now scored the same number of goals for Liverpool as compatriot at Dietmar Hamann, 11 in 140 fewer matches. To which Didi Haman said, he's also won 8 fewer trophies. Didi actually said 8 less trophies, and I just changed the grammar myself there. Daniel Sturridge scored again. I mean, he hasn't scored millions, but he's starting to score some goals. How much hope do you hold for Daniel Sturridge?
Well, until he plays like a series of games without interruption, it's very hard to say. And you just wonder if the makeup of the squad allows him to recover to a point where people really believe in him. I think that's the question.
Always just going to be the understudy right now to Harry Kane, such as that form and the consistency that Kane has shown. I think maybe there was a time 2 or 3 years ago where Harry Kane wasn't quite in the same form, where you would have looked to Daniel Sturridge in terms of the way that he was playing. But I think the standards that Harry Kane has now set puts, I think, Daniel Sturridge's performance in a different light.
Liverpool missed another penalty at 1-0. Their fifth penalty miss in 7. which is pretty bad.
This is nothing new for a Jurgen Klopp side, should say. They missed, I think, all four penalties at Anfield in 2017, I read. And that I was going to point out that when Klopp won the league with Borussia Dortmund in 2011, they had six penalties that season and they missed all of them, despite the fact they won the league.
In the group's other game, Sevilla moved up to second by beating Spartak 2-1. So Liverpool atop, Sevilla a second. Both need points to guarantee going through. Celtic 1, Bayern 2. Fitbar, Barry. They were good Celtic, weren't they?
They were. Very impressive. And still not quite good enough, which must be depressing for them because, you know, they really stepped up. I thought they might actually get something from the game. I know I facetiously referred to their, you know, forthcoming defeat against Bayern, but Bayern were missing a lot of important players. Celtic were at home, obviously, and they're generally good, you know, for a shock result in a lot of European campaigns, if not all of them. But they played as probably as well as they can play, and still weren't quite good enough against a below strength Bayern Munich side. So while they should be very encouraged by a great performance, it must be pretty depressing for their fans to see that even when they're at top of their game, they're not good enough to compete in the Champions League.
Was really impressed by Celtic in terms of the way they went about it. Okay, for example, you do have a few players missing. The fact that Robert Lewandowski is not starting up front for Bayern 4, I think that only a handful of times has that happened in the last few years. That's certainly an advantage and something to be got at there. But the way that Kieran Tierney acquitted himself, particularly Ian Robben, I would say in both legs, didn't find much joy against Kieran Tierney. I think that's a very encouraging performance by him once again. But the fact that it took until the 67th minute for Craig Gordon to make his first big save from James Rodriguez or indeed any Bayern player, I think that said a lot about the Celtic performance and how they were able to shut them out. I think that there will be a few players, for example, who will come back at the weekend against Borussia Dortmund who weren't starting, the likes of Lewandowski, Mats Hummels, Joshua Kimmich, Thiago Alcantara, who didn't start. These are all very key players. So I would say, how much do you read into the Celtic performance when they're not playing against the very best Bayern side, perhaps, but there was still more than enough there, I would say, as Barry says, to take encouragement.
You can only not beat what's in front of you.
Andy.
It's amazing the gap that Lewandowski left, I felt. And not just that, you know, that there wasn't someone to replace him who was of sufficient quality. Obviously, there's a lot of quality in that Bayern squad. But in terms of there not really being another out-and-out striker there, I guess they would have put Thomas Müller in had he been fit. But in terms of them not being able to hold the ball up, having no focal point, as I said elsewhere, the ball coming straight back at them when they lost it, which you know, certainly had implications to the flow of the game in the second half. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, in Germany recently about Hasan Salihamidžić, the sporting director, saying we need to find a backup for Lewandowski in winter, and Lewandowski himself saying, look, I can't play all the games, let's be real.
I like you say in winter, like that's just when he hibernates, yeah, like a squirrel.
They all hibernate in winter. It's what German football is all about. But I think that they haven't got someone who can go anywhere near backing up Lewandowski. It's an issue, isn't it?
It is. And it's been talked about how when Jupp Heynckes won the Champions League with Bayern the last time that he was in charge of the club, he did have a few strikers to choose from, the likes of Mario Mandzukic, and even Claudio Pizarro could come in and do a job, for example. There's another striker I'm forgetting right now, his name doesn't come.
Mario Gomez,
he was quite good as well, so, and still plays occasionally for Wolfsburg, albeit not that well right now. But I think that's a key talking point in Germany right now. Kind of Bayern need to go out and find a backup striker. And I think they've not conceded a goal yet in the Bundesliga under Heynckes since he's returned. In fact, Borussia Dortmund seem to be cursed since Heynckes has returned because they've only picked up 1 point in three games and Bayern have managed to claw back an 8 point gap which Dortmund had over them. So I think that at present, Bayern aren't as defensively flawless as Celtic showed the other night. They've had to play their last three games before this against sides who have gone down to 10 men with plenty of the game to go, which I think has very much helped them have a little bit of an easy ride. But I still think that, particularly with Lewandowski, it didn't look right seeing, okay, they were trying a false nine tactic where they were trying to rotate the likes of Robben and James and Kingsley Coman all leading the line.
Even Tolisso got in there at one point, didn't he? Yeah.
Which says something in itself. Arturo Vidal that far up the pitch as well is something which didn't look too pretty.
I love the look on his face when he came off. It's like, man, I'm just having my turn at playing centre forward and you're bringing me off.
Oh Lord! There's been a tea dessert. Rin Tutt has poured tea all over the studio. It's all right, we'll clear
that's
it up.
Karma
with, that's
here.
The use of the G2 section. There we are. Keep the this fact. In, Mel. This is breaking news. Oh. It seems to be dripping on some wires as well. Maybe an issue. I mean, look at it. I mean, there is not a lot of sort of manual skill, I would say, in this. We're just looking at some wires covered in tea, going. I reckon it's okay.
I was going to say that I thought that it was impressive how Arturo Vidal miscontrolled the ball less than 2 seconds into the game, but I think any comment I should make on that would be
your first touch wasn't the best there.
No, my first touch was not good.
Though. I would say what we should do is certainly save what we recorded just in case we go off air, but just carry on regardless. How long has this been the Clásica, this Dortmund-Bayern game? Like a week or like forever?
Not forever, since the Bundesliga wanted to market it in this way.
I see.
Internationally, but I wouldn't say that you've got kind of fans talking about it in those terms necessarily. In Germany, they talk about this as a very big game, and it is certainly the biggest game in German football at present. But I think that such is the way that Bayern Munich have dominated the German football scene, particularly in the last five years or so. It does take a little bit of the sting out of it, but I think that Dortmund, along with Leipzig, are still the biggest challenges to Bayern, although after this weekend they could pull even further clear of them and what looked like a very promising title race could be disappearing into the horizon.
PSG beat Anderlecht 5-0. Most goals scored in the Champions League, 17. Fewest conceded, 0. Most goals after four Champions League groups games ever.
Most hat-tricks by a left-back in probably ever?
Hat-tricks by left-backs?
I mean you don't get many hat-tricks by a left-back. I realise it's only one, but because I was done a pretty good job. Of course, he did train as a centre-forward when he was a youth,
okay,
before being later converted to a left-back, as happens eventually to every left-footed player.
Do you reckon Bale ever scored a hat-trick while playing as a left-back? Probably not.
I feel pretty sure he would have done, right?
No, I'm not sure. I think the ones he scored for Spurs when he was playing further forward, I can't think. Maybe Andy Hinchcliffe scored from three corners direct once. Anyway, you can add to that fullbacks who scored hat-tricks. Are they the favourites then, PSG? Given that, you know, Real Madrid, well, none of the Spanish sides won this week, which is strange, isn't it?
I think there's a
Sevilla one, didn't they?
But of course, it's easy to say that at the moment. I think to look at Paris and Manchester City as the favourites simply because they're so convincing at the moment. That Real Madrid and Barcelona, and though Barcelona have been very good domestically, I think there's a sense that they're playing at the very tip of their capabilities. That they're not going to get much better from here on in, perhaps, and Bayern have their issues as well. So I think it's the other runners and riders that make Paris and City so fancied at the moment. But it's early. It's still the group stage.
PSG will not win the Champions League.
But what's interesting is it's not obvious who's going to win it. And I suppose it never is, but then it normally turns out to be one of who you expect might be. And actually this year could be more interesting. I might stop part two a little early. It might be a good idea to dry the electrical sockets. I'm not an expert. I just think it's a good idea. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to part two, the appendix, the post-tea clear-up appendix, where we'll do the rest of the Champions League.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay, Archie. Look, it added some live entertainment to the pod. Olympiacos 0, Barcelona 0. Barcelona failed to score in a Champions League group game for the first time since December 2012. is it a game, Manny, that they should have won easily and didn't, or did they not play very well?
Yeah, they had the chances. Silvio Proto, the goalkeeper for Olympiacos, had a very good game. But I suppose what was the interesting angle to it is so little focus has been on Barcelona's new coach, Ernesto Valverde, until now. And I think he's done a terrific job. And, of course, there was all that fuss at the start of the season about the board. There was the Neymar thing, Dembélé getting injured, all the rest of it, and as well as what's happening off the pitch in Barcelona and in Catalonia in general. It's kind of overshadowed what excellent work he's done. But this was really the Ernesto Valverde celebration week, because he's been the coach of Olympiacos twice, and the locals were very, very excited about him coming back. He got presented with the little golden Athenian crown before the start.
Did he have to wear it president for the game?
They look pretty small. I'm not sure it would have fitted on his head.
Okay.
I think it was merely decorative.
Right,
it had mantelpiece written all over it, really. But I don't know. I think it's a bit of a stretch to say Barcelona took their eye off the ball for that reason. But it was a bit of a strange environment for them.
Any other game? Sporting drew 1-1 with Juventus. Barca and Juve both missed the chance to qualify. They meet in match day 5, which will be fun.
Sporting were really great, actually. And Gonzalo Higuain, who scored those two against Milan last weekend, of course, he pitched in with another one, which was really useful for Juventus. Though, on the other hand, I think the Olympiacos-Barcelona result kind of works against them, because now in the fifth game, when Barcelona go to Juventus, and of course Juventus are very strong at home, but Barcelona still need to qualify. They haven't qualified just yet. So, you know, maybe there's a little window for Sporting. It'll still be Barcelona and Juve qualifying, I'm sure. But it keeps the suspense going a little bit.
Group G, Porto 3, RB Leipzig 1. Archie, Timo Werner's first Champions League goal was good, but it was not enough.
Leipzig's performance, as you say, was not quite there. I think they're still a little bit green in this competition, perhaps in a Tottenham phase, if you will, in terms of just getting used to it. They have a very strong young side. I think there is real squad depth there, but there still needs time to evolve. Naby Keita wasn't great again for second Champions League away game running. He's going through a bit of an interesting phase. 3 red cards in the last month or so. I think Liverpool fans on the outside might read that as okay, he's somebody who's going to get stuck in. But I would say that it's more been over-exuberance on that side. He didn't get sent off, we should add, against Porto. But
which is an achievement.
Yeah, it's a headline. Yes. It's a headline.
Exactly. But no, Leipzig was struggling to defend from set-piece situations. So I think they conceded across the two games against Porto, 4 goals conceded from set-piece situations. But is that what you say in English? You just say
something. Have you been in Germany too long, do you think? You've said
German
it now.
Word, the German word is Standardsituation, which... Yeah.
The best German word is gums, is Zahnfleisch, teeth meat.
There's many more. But
there are many other German words.
There are many other...
Don't just get around with these situations and gums.
See how many of them we can think of.
Beşiktaş drew 1-1 with Monaco. Lovely goal from Marcos Lopez for Monaco. Bent one in from 20 yards. ID 0820762 says, hey, no babble this week, referring to Monday's pod. You really should see these things through. Yeah, it was the first pod of the season. We didn't mention Ryan Babel. Jonathan Wilson has written an article about him in The Independent. He's on Monday, so we'll go big on Babel on
actually,
Monday.
When we finished the record on Monday, the first thing I said was, we didn't mention Ryan Babel.
Mm.
And there was brief talk of, well, is there some way we could press record again and crowbar him in? Just
that's
to keep
not
it going.
Really, yeah, that's not on,
I mean,
is it?
His major contribution against Monaco was Cenk Tosun, who's his shoulder bump colleague, of course. Whenever one of them score, they do the NBA shoulder bump, don't they? And and Cenk Tosun scored the equaliser from the penalty spot. But it's a lovely open group anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you look at the game still to go, you would think Monaco, bottom of the group, would be more or less out of it. But that point actually keeps them alive, and when you look at the games they've got, they're playing Leipzig at home and then they've got to go to Porto on the last game. I mean, it really is, it's the worst possible group for Leipzig to go into the Champions League, isn't it? Because it's not that glamorous and it's really hard.
I think that they will learn a lot from this, but I think you've got 4 sides who are actually on a very similar level. There is no, I would say, clear favourite from that group or hasn't been. So in a way, that's as we saw last season with Spurs. I think that that's almost a difficult one to play. But I think that, yeah, the way that Leipzig are evolving, I really rate their coach, Ralf Hasenhüttl, very highly.
I'll tell you what, though, he's got a challenge, because the way that Porto played that, I mean, I know it's something that Leipzig have had to cope with domestically, but Porto said, okay, you have the ball, which is something that Leipzig have found quite difficult to cope with. I mean, a couple of their players have talked about that, haven't they? I mean, I think Marcel Sabitzer said recently, or actually maybe it was Timo Werner, saying, oh, what do we do with all this possession when other teams give us the ball? How do we counter-attack them? And I think it's quite interesting that the thought of that has spread to Europe rather than just staying domestically. It shows how much their work's respected all over the continent.
So focused on scoring within 8 seconds of losing the ball, that whole Rangnick philosophy, that, yeah, I think that perhaps with the ball they do struggle a little bit more, but yet they have some really great players when they do have the ball, the likes of Keita, whose dribbling quality, I don't think there is a better central midfielder in the Bundesliga at the moment, so Liverpool will be able to benefit from that at least next season.
Yeah, just get a Bassett or a Beck or a, you know, a Pulis in and just sell it. When you've got it, hit the channels, knock it long, you'll lose the ball, get it back in 8 seconds, score a goal. Europa League games tonight. Arsenal play Red Star Belgrade. Arsenal top, 3 wins from 3 in their group. Everton go to Lyon. They've only got 1 point so far. As yet, we don't know if David Unsworth has taken any of Joey Barton's advice and has started a sort of carb-free diet. Perhaps sort of Unsworth should have a weigh-in before every game. Because obviously the lighter he gets, the better he'll be as a football manager. That's officially the end of part two. And now we'll move on to part three without a break, because we've had our break already, Archie. Those of you who read The Guardian on a regular basis will know the work of the brilliant football cartoonist David Squires. He's got a book out, so we've decided to ring him up and ask him about his book, so you then buy it, which is good news for him. I'm very pleased to say he's on the phone now, all the way from Australia, to talk about it. David, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, good, thank you. Tell us all about your book. Make it sound great, and then everyone listening will buy it.
So, yeah, it's a collection of cartoons of some of my favourite players, managers, some of the innovators, some of the absolute bastards who are integral to all football teams. I've tried to pull together a list of players that represent as many clubs, nationalities, playing positions. And anyone who's familiar with my sort of weekly cartoons knows the kind of thing to expect. I've tried to make some of them a bit longer, so the Maradona one is 4 or 5 pages long. And yes, it's out today.
What's it called, David?
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
It's called Hall of Fame.
David, your cartoon is, I don't know if you're aware of how just incredibly popular it is every week here in The Guardian. In The Office, we all look forward, is Squires in yet? Weirdly, my articles aren't anticipated like that. But, you know, for example, in your latest one, you have Jose Mourinho vomiting up, tornado's worth of hairy gonads. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think as a child that you would end up earning your living in such magnificent fashion?
That probably wasn't the most subtle cartoon I've ever drawn. No, there wasn't much nuance in that one. But I did actually. I've only been doing this full time for a couple of years now, and it funnily enough, it did actually take me 2 years. It was only the other day that I sat and thought, this is a little bit midlife crisis-y, you know, like. I gave up a sort of a proper job to do this. It does feel a little bit like focusing full time on my air guitaring or something like that. But a very understanding partner who seems to be okay with me sitting at home drawing Portuguese managers spewing testes. So yeah, it's an odd job, yeah, but it's fun and I love doing it.
What did you do before?
I was a project manager in vocational education and training.
So I have no further questions.
Am I correct in thinking, David, you used to work for West Ham in some sort of administrative role?
I did. I worked in the ticket office there and also at Swindon Town. And one of the first paying art jobs I had, or one of the first commissions, was designing the mascots at both of those football clubs. And Herbie the Hammer has since been superseded by a more sort of muscular character, but the sort of tatty one at Swindon's still going. And this would have been, I think, 1998 I was doing this. And I could well still have been doing it, but at one point I was given the task to design the Bristol City mascot. And as a Swindon Town fan myself, I saw this as an opportunity to lumber Bristol City with a ridiculous mascot, but I didn't quite have the discipline to make it just bad enough that it would actually be made. I went too far and was fired.
David, I have to ask, as you're a Swindon Town fan, you're not responsible for the mural of Jan Åge Fjørtoft on the side of the ground, are you?
I'm not, no.
Well, that's a relief.
No. I'm not going to pass comment on that, but I know the yeah, I know the one you mean, yeah. That's not me.
Obviously, all the things that we hate about football, you know, corruption, racism, homophobia, all the things that we need to rid of football, basically make up all your material, David, don't they? So are you like, when another FIFA corruption scandal comes in, are you like, yeah, wicked?
Yeah, I probably am the only one who misses Sepp Blatter. He just really had so much front. He's complete. I don't need to describe to you what Sepp Blatter was like, but he was great fun to draw, you know, sort of little penguin kind of character. But yeah, I mean, I despair as much as everyone at some of the things that go on. You might have seen just sort of this week or a few weeks ago, I did a cartoon which showed a couple of characters head to toe covered in poppies, and they're berating another player who's only wearing one. And I didn't think in my wildest dreams that image would come pretty close to coming true last weekend. As much as it is useful for me professionally, I do still have a soul somewhere.
Has anyone who you've ever drawn got in touch with you and then taken issue with your cartoon as such?
or asked for a print or whatever they're called?
It happens occasionally. The one that sticks in my mind is Steve McMahon. He was at Swindon at the time. He was Swindon manager. The club had asked me to do a caricature of him that could be sold in the club shop, which I did. I set about that, and he saw it and he called me the worst word in the English language, and he said that I'd made him look like Paul Daniels, which you know, unfortunately, I was only about 19. I didn't sort of quite have the strength to. So, you know, well, if the cap fits kind of thing. But I just shrank like a salted snail and took my drawing and skulked off. So, but yeah, every now and again, people do get in touch. But that's the one that I'm still scarred by.
Alison, great to talk to you. Thanks for coming on, David. The book is called Hall of Fame and it is out now and everyone should buy it, correct?
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Everyone should buy it.
All right, brilliant. Thanks for coming on, David.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
No worries. David Squires there. They are good, aren't they?
It's the highlight of the week in the office when Squires is in. Like it's kind of like someone rings a bell. Squires is in. All right. It's printed off and it passed around. That doesn't happen with anyone else in the Guardian's work that I'm aware of.
Let's look ahead then to the Premier League games this weekend. Sunday's exciting, isn't it? You've got Spurs, Palace, Manchester City, Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United. Which one? And Everton Watford.
Everton Watford, yes, Max.
Well, I don't care about either of them. And Everton Watford as well, yeah. Which game are you most excited about, Andy Brassel?
Everton Watford's a very interesting one, I think, as you should come to mention it. Obviously,
Smugly there, Barry. Yes, you're right, Andy. Carry on.
Because Watford have had that little dip recently. I've heard it suggested that it's since Troy Deeney lauded it over Arsenal. I would suggest the two things are perhaps unconnected and that Watford were due a little dip at some point. But whether Watford can come back and do something from there, because really Silva wants to be pushing up towards that top seven, doesn't he? And Everton, well, it feels like they've got a lot of sorting out to do. Obviously, we might know the identity of their new full-time manager by then.
God almighty. I'm knocked over a mug. There isn't much in it.
There are more tissues. Seriously. It would never happen in the old regime, would it? It just did that for you, Archie. You need a cagoule, Andy. Man City Arsenal, to me, looks... Because you worry that Chelsea Manchester United will be a goalless draw, don't you, Barry?
I'm not worried about it at all. I'm just fairly certain it will be a goalless draw.
Whereas we think Archie Manchester City Arsenal won't be.
No, given the fact that City have scored 35 goals in 10 games this season, which I think is nearly double the amount that Arsenal have managed, you would imagine that will be something of a goal fest. And I think if Arsene Wenger loses that, then the pressure will crank up again. But yeah, I think we know the eternal circle now that he will remain.
I'm sure if Arsenal get turned over, absolutely nothing will change.
Yep.
I think that's what you mean.
That was basically the point that I was making.
The same ring to it.
Spurs Palace as well on Sunday. Saturday, Stoke Leicester's the early game. Huddersfield play West Brom, Newcastle, Bournemouth. Southampton, Burnley, Swansea, Brighton and West Ham, Liverpool.
West Ham have got quite a few defenders out. I'm kind of wondering who's actually going to play for them on Saturday.
Most of the defenders that have been playing haven't been too wonderful.
No,
I'd suggest
that's true. But particularly given the run that they've got coming up in the next few weeks, in terms of Liverpool, Watford, Everton, Leicester, Chelsea, City, and Arsenal. Some of them sound much more winnable than others. But I think that. I think a bad result for Slaven Bilic is going to further turn the heat up there. And unlike the Arsenal situation, I think something is more likely to happen there, given the pressure that he's under.
Yeah, probably. Championship news. Ed writes, question for Barry. There are rumours Sunderland might appoint Peter Reid as manager. Would they be better off sticking him in midfield? And Chet Wengo says, Barry, League One is complete and utter fun. Sunderland will love it down there. I support Carlisle. To be fair, Leeds fans always seem to have fun when we played them. Simon Grayson sacked after a 3-3 draw at home to Bolton. 1-15, his record. Sunderland, 0 home wins in 2017-19 matches. I was speaking to Andy Dawson from Atletico Mintz yesterday, and he was saying Sunderland in 2017 have been in the lead at the Stadium of Light for 3 minutes. How do you feel about it all, Baz?
Not hugely surprised. I think the decision to get rid of Grayson was harsh, but I think it was a poor decision on his part to take the job in the first place. I don't think anyone in their right mind would want that job unless they're absolutely desperate. And if they're that desperate, then they're probably not the right person for the job. The club is totally dysfunctional. The players are overpaid, don't care. We had that incident earlier this season, Darren Gibson was drunk in a bar and, was recorded surreptitiously saying we're effing shit. There are too many players at the club who don't give an F. So he, in vino veritas, I completely believe what he was saying there. It's no great surprise. They have an annual wage bill of 30 million. Louise Taylor wrote a good article yesterday, have Sunderland become unmanageable? And reading her article and reading other articles about the club and listening to Jonathan Wilson talk about the club and the experience of what happened, how badly they handled the Adam Johnson thing, rumours of a drinking culture in the dressing room, of too much player power. I'm drawn to, Gus Poyet, an interview with Sid Lowe, said, there's something inside Sunderland, something at its very core. It's hard to explain, but there's a way of life, something deep down that makes it difficult to fulfil its potential. If I knew what it was, I'd say, but it's there and it needs to be changed at the root. Is it like he's talking about some sort of creature from a horror movie? But I think things will get a lot worse before they start to get better.
Right, tomorrow night Wolves get a chance to increase their lead at the top to 4 points. They take on Fulham. How will Rindo see this going?
He's quite pessimistic at the moment about the way things are going, but I think that it didn't help that there's been some interesting goings on at the club this week with the statistical analyst Craig Klein finally leaving the club. I think that's caused a lot of problems in the last year. For a few years or so, he's very good friends with Tony Khan, who is the son of Shahid Khan, who holds a high position in the club as well. I think that there have been recruitment problems at the club this season. If people are interested in what's happening at Fulham, but you look at the signing, for example, of a Spanish defender called Marcelo Diallo, who has barely played, and Jokanovic obviously doesn't think is good enough. But there was this whole system called both boxes ticked, which meant that they needed to be approved by the statistical department as well. And
it's like the thick of it, basically.
It does seem a bit thick of it. But Slavisa Jokanovic, in terms of the job that he's done, I mean, there's a few fans now calling for him to be shipped on, which I think is really quite unfair given the job that he's done at the club. I think the fact that they finished in the playoff positions last season was a miracle given the way that they played in previous seasons. But Tom Kearney, who's not been fit, I would imagine will leave at the end of the season if Fulham aren't up in the promotion places. But the way that Wolves are playing at the moment, I don't see Fulham getting anything. So I see an unhappy dad there, I'm afraid.
Producer Mel was at Wolves' victory over Norwich. Carol wrote and said they were very, very good and will almost certainly get promoted.
Cardiff a second, they go to fourth place. Bristol City in Saturday's early kickoff. Sheffield United a third, they face Hull. Leonard Slutsky said after the 3-1 defeat to Borough, I think 15 matches is normal time for a decision, and if the owner decides about me, I will agree, no problem about being sacked.
I really wanted him to do well at Hull, and I'm kind of sad he hasn't. That's all I have to say about that.
That's okay. Barry, do you want to talk to us about Stan Collymore's TV show or not?
Must I?
No, you don't have to.
No, it's fine. Stan has... he's taking the RT, formerly Russia Today, ruble, or dollar, or whatever, and has recorded a series of programmes called The Stan Collymore Show, which starts tomorrow on RT. He's got stick from people, including me, for working for this, you know, what, Kremlin-funded propaganda wing. I don't think his show is going to be particularly, propaganda-y, although he has said he insisted to me he had total autonomy, lots of help, but total autonomy in deciding the content, and he wasn't told to take any particular editorial line. And I was at the launch of it, and I must say it looks pretty good.
Did you ask him, sorry, if the Russians, because we have been nominated by the Football Supporters Federation for best podcast, and I thought maybe we could get the Russians involved because they can help with some with votes, can't they? Because it'd be good to win that.
It would be good. Yeah. We're the reigning champions.
Yeah, and you know, we've been about for the whole year as well, which should help potentially in these sort of things.
Yeah, I have second captains from Ireland. Yeah, they've been nominated. That's for the first time. I think that's an interesting one thrown into the mix. But yeah, so listener, if you go to the Football Supporters Federation website or our blog and vote for us and vote for The Guardian and vote for David Squires and vote for Jonathan Wilson.
While we're on admin, we've got a live show on the 14th of December at the Emmanuel Centre in London. Me, Baz, Barney, Jonathan Wilson, more to be announced. Come so that the audience is bigger than the panel. Please, that would be great. Feedback corner. This was on the most like a PE teacher. Tom says, after Joey Barton said that David Unsworth looked like a PE teacher, Paul Clement was a PE teacher. So he has to be the correct answer. John says, Glenn Roeder does geography and PE, which is a classic combo, isn't it? Purple Canary says, Nigel Pearson, surely more an army drill instructor than a school PE teacher.
The manager of Benfica, Rui Vitória, started out as a PE teacher as well.
If, he was up if, against... If somebody forgets Jose their kit... Vest and pants, Twitch. Did he do that? that's probably before your time as well, Archie, isn't it? On the length of the pod, which gets much discussion, G. Dinby says, it's getting better. It's like we've started to achieve match fitness to reach 90 minutes, with many people in disbelief that Glenn Denning hasn't hit the pub at half-time, coming back with a slightly optimistic view on life and a hand-drawn portrait of Marcus Rashford on the back of a fag packet. And Matt Fish says, as a child in my household, pods was a polite way of saying testicles. I still struggle with the word pod being used as an abbreviation for podcast. I'm not suggesting you change your rhetoric because of my testicles. I just thought I'd highlight my discomfort.
Sorry about that.
Pert Loves Crisp says, I very much enjoyed you guys discussing Max being part of the Movember advert and then having him plug Gillette to close out the show. Whose side are you on?
Well, you know, you can't grow a moustache without a razor.
Exactly right. A lot of people do Movember under duress. You're pulling them both ways. Shame on you, Max. Baz, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Archie.
Thank you, Max.
Love to Rindo.
We'll do.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.